Greetings, friends. I'm John Haspel. This is a recording of our Saturday morning Truth of Happiness Dhamma study, Sangha discussion on the Four Foundations of Mindfulness, and Dhamma talk that introduces the third week study of the Four Noble Truths. This was recorded on December 24th, 2016, at Cross River Meditation Center in Frenchtown, New Jersey. If you find benefit from this talk, please consider a donation. Thank you. Peace. So just so everyone knows, I think you know, that we're streaming today's class. And so I'd like to hear how your study went, if you did on Shamatha Vipassana meditation, if you have any questions or comments. And I'll start with Luke. How was your study on that first chapter?
It's going well. I guess from Tuesday, I feel like I was in a little bit of a better space. Yeah. Just wrapping up the rest of the week with holiday stuff and work stuff and a holiday work Christmas party and stuff like that. I don't know, for some reason I had a lot of anxiety about it. I also doing a little different format than usual this year. For the past, as long as I can remember, 20 years or so, starting around the holidays, like the alcohol intake and everything would really kind of skyrocket and kind of move right through Christmas and become a New Year's resolution that would kind of move into the middle of the following year and so on and so on. So I was finally able to sort of gain some control over that perpetual madness. And it's been really refreshing since Thanksgiving to be like in a sober headspace and trying to get through the holidays in definitely a different mindset. Approach to my life, approach to my family, approach to my work, everything. It's not all positive, you know. There's a lot of like negative reflection, a lot of like toxic stuff coming out at a weird time or whatever that's surfacing. I use Matt's term of like peeling away the layers of the onion in terms of the ego and. That's always a very helpful perspective. But yeah, just sort of going along with my process, trying to be as easy as I can on myself, and it's been all in all, it's been good. But I get overwhelmed by the practice of it. You know that it's work, because that was sort of like where I would gravitate towards, like going for a drink or whatever. Just that it was sort of a relief. And getting away from the work and the practice and just sort of putting everything on hold for a little bit. Yeah. To sort of carve out this artificial me space, so to speak, you know? So I don't know, it's just been a vastly different approach with a lot to it. But trying to focus around this practice and this some fundamental principles and getting back to just some good, healthy mind space has really been refreshing, so I thank you greatly for that.
You're certainly welcome, and thank you for that just remarkable explanation of what you gained so far. You referred to things are coming up. That's simply an aspect of the First Noble Truth. The Dhamma is not an escape from dukkha, from things coming up, from difficult situations. It's a way of seeing these things in the proper perspective, meaning it's some of those things are simply part of life. And as we develop the ability to control our thinking and control our resulting actions, we're able to minimize our own contribution to stress. And again, that's exactly what you're describing. The ability to recognize that maybe excessive alcohol is not in anyone's best interest, including your own, is also an aspect of concentration. Your mind has quieted enough just to see what's occurring. Again, it's a simple, practical application of the Dhamma. So good for you, and thank you for sharing that. Dan, welcome to our Sangha. How was your meditation?
It was great. It was right in the zone. You know, it was just... I had a great drive. I drove an hour and a half to get here. I live in Brick, New Jersey, which is by Point Pleasant.
Yeah, I know.
I've been friends with Luke for a year, so came here for him and this, and I love the space. This is really awesome. I wish something was like this around me, but
yeah.
So it's just a really enjoyable ride through the farms and everything to get here. And So I just sitting and being quiet, listening to the cars with the wet road and just letting it be and breathing and just kind of keep coming back. It, you know, it's just uneventful but perfect.
Yeah, that's a good way to describe it. Yeah, it should be uneventful. And you're able to maintain the method. Just recognize you're caught up in your thinking, come back to your breathing.
Sure.
That's the basic practice, and it's both of those components. The reason why I say that is many people will think that it's only to be mindful of your breath, and if you're thinking, you're just doing something wrong, and that's not it. The meditation method is not about developing a trance-like state or a quality of mind where you're not aware of your own thinking. It's to be simply not distracted by your thoughts, and that's how this develops. And I should say that meditation is one factor of the Eightfold Path. So in other words, I teach meditation within that broader framework, and all eight factors are mutually supportive and really necessary for developing a quiet and peaceful mind and a life of lasting peace and happiness. So I'm glad you came this morning.
Thank you.
There's a yellow booklet, instruction book for this. Please take it.
Sure.
As you're starting out of practice, I recommend you start with short periods of time. Consistency is much more important than length of meditation session. So even if you're starting with 2 or 3 or 4 minutes, but if you can do that consistently twice a day, very quickly you'll have an established meditation practice. And then continue to join us. I know it's a long ride, but it's a
Oh, no, I may.
I hope you can. It's a long ride, but I'm glad you're here this morning.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for bringing me. Anthony, good to see you.
Good morning, John.
Good morning.
I have been meditating more faithfully lately. Like, I was pretty good before, but I'm definitely on target, and I notice a big difference in how much calmer I am and how much I'm able to go with the flow. And because I had back to back, like, taking testimony from a doctor Thursday night and then starting a trial Friday, and I was just completely present, you know. It's just like, and the fighting didn't even faze me at all. In fact, when I got to court, I noticed the one attorney just jumped all over me. It was just attacking me, and I just realized it wasn't about me because I didn't do anything. And the judge was trying to protect me. He goes, "Hey, you just lost 2 fathers. Like, back off." And I just said, "Are you okay? How's everything going for you?" And then he started telling me about how horrible the last lawyer was. And I realized, you know, so, and then I just started, you know, wishing him a happy Christmas, and things just quickly turned around. And I realized, had I gone at it the same mode, it would have just escalated.
Yeah.
It would have been horrible. And so I think that's kind of the benefit of the practice. I read the mindfulness article today. I thought it was excellent.
Which one?
The one that you posted for
today.
Oh,
for the 4 Foundations of Mindfulness?
Yeah.
Thank you.
And I had a question for you about that, because I think it's kind of interesting that you start out, before you get into this practice, being very judgmental of yourself, and then you could go to the positive aspect and love yourself, but mindfulness is just accepting yourself.
Yep. Big difference.
Yeah. Yeah, and I thought, wow. But isn't there a place for positive imaging, too? Isn't there benefit in that? You know, and so I started wondering, should it all be mindfulness, or should there be some positive imaging and some positive feelings in there too?
It's a reasonable question. In fact, more than a reasonable question. and I'll try to give a brief answer, but you know that's not likely coming from me. The positivity of the Dhamma is reflected in the refuges, the understanding that a human being, the three refuges are, we take refuge in the Buddha, the Dhamma, the teachings, and the Sangha. What that means is true refuge in the Buddha isn't worshiping the Buddha. He never set himself up that way. Simply that a human being has done what we're hoping to do, to find our own individual contributions to stress and unhappiness and eliminate them. Taking refuge in the Dhamma is taking refuge or comfort in the fact that he left a teaching on how to do this exactly. And then taking refuge in a Sangha, a true Sangha that's well focused. So that's where the positivity of it is. Years and years ago, what was the gentleman's name? Oh, I can't think of it now. There was a big movement called the Power of Positive Thinking. I wish I could think of the guy.
Is it Neil Carnegie?
No.
Norman Vincent Peale.
Yeah, yeah. And so, and I'm not putting that down. My mother was a big fan. I remember listening to Carlton Fredericks always talking about Norman Vincent Peale on his radio show. And how important it is to hold positive thoughts and see everything in a positive light. But if you understand how much that contradicts the first noble truth, and that can become almost this, it does become a conditioned type of thinking, that I must see everything in a positive light, I cannot see anything negative in the world. Well, that just contradicts the first noble truth. Dukkha occurs, there's going to be unsatisfactory experiences. When we insist that everything be positive in our life, that's a way of saying, this is the only way I want to experience life. So we can get caught up. And it may be a fine line between what you're holding in mind and what you're hoping to aspire to, but seeing things in reality in relation to the Four Noble Truths is different than holding a positive outlook on life. Yeah. It's simply seeing things in reality. I don't want to go on much further than that, but you bring up a very good point.
You could image a good thought, but accept a bad outcome.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, so there's nothing, and it's not wrong to see life as an incredible opportunity, because that's what it is. And it becomes even more meaningful when we've developed the right framework for how to see life, because then stress doesn't arrive. And that your interaction with the lawyer and the judge in that court is a perfect example of that. You've developed the Dhamma enough where you don't take things personally. And that's the key to lasting peace and happiness. There was no you in there for the other lawyer to bounce up against. You didn't give him an Anthony that's holding a position. You just simply let him be who he was. And that's how we maintain our peace and happiness. We don't take things personally. And you saw immediately there was nothing, he wasn't really attacking you. He was really attacking his own mind, but I don't want to get into that, almost a metaphor. The idea of mindfulness, especially the refined, I'm going to go on a little bit longer. Mindfulness means to recollect or to hold in mind, which means we can hold anything in mind. We can hold positive thoughts in mind. We can hold negative thoughts in mind if they're self-referential. But when we let go of self-referential view, there's no room for even a positive or a negative thought. We're simply seeing life as it occurs. So when we have a beautiful sunset, we're able to recognize it. But if it's a cloudy day, we're still at peace. When we interact with someone who's aggressive and competitive with us, we don't have to react. Just as you described, we can stay at peace. And that's really the key to lasting peace and happiness. We don't fall into our old habits of around the holiday we stay drunk a lot. You know, it sounds like something. For years and years and years, New Year's Eve was the greatest. I mean, I drank every day of my life up to a certain point, but New Year's Eve was a great excuse, you know. Now it's just another night. It's something that occurs. And all of that comes from understanding our own contributions to stress. And you described it beautifully, so thank you.
Thank you.
Glad you're here. Becky, welcome to our Sangha. How was your meditation?
I think I'm starting to get there, but what I find that I'm doing is I intellectualize it too much.
Yep.
Instead of just sort of letting it happen,
yep.
I try to figure out what exactly I'm doing right, or what I'm doing when I feel like it's working, what did I do to make it,
yeah.
Instead of just letting it be. So I hope that I'll be able to not be so hard on myself and just let it be. One of the reasons that
I do it all the time, Mom.
Yeah, and this is the place for that, so don't.
One of the reasons I wanted to come here is because I've seen Jennifer handle difficult situations in her job the way, what's your name again?
Anthony
just described. And it has made her so much happier, so much more at peace. And I just said to myself, I need to maybe learn how to do that. Or just when I went to Matt, I started going to bat when my mother died, and I was having a lot of trouble with that. And what I learned from him was that you can just let go.
Yeah.
And there was a couple of times that he talked to me through that feeling of just letting go. And it just felt so wonderful that I want to be able to do it for myself. So, I'm going to keep coming and reading your articles and practicing, like you said, in short periods.
Yeah. Well, thank you for saying all that. And again, welcome to our Sangha. Everything that is taught here and taught by the Buddha is taught for a very practical reason, is so that we can see these situations clearly. When we have a reaction in our mind, we recognize that that is appropriate at that time. In other words, you'll hear me say, as long as you keep coming to class, we gain the ability to be at peace with less than peaceful mind states. Our minds don't have to be any different, but we're present with life as life occurs. And it does take some effort, but it's not an impossible effort, isn't it?
No.
And really, it's everyone that I've ever taught that actually applies this, and it's not that I'm the world's greatest teacher, I may be, but we're talking about a true lineage, and what I mean by that is something that was put in place over 2,600 years ago is still present in this room, and that's that second part of the refuge, taking refuge in the Dhamma. And everyone that applies it develops exactly the same way. They develop a peaceful and calm mind, and that's the point. So you're in the right spot. Even that intellectual approach that you're talking about, that's how everyone starts. And if you remember, another thing you'll hear me say often is be very, very gentle with yourself, especially during meditation practice. As long as you're maintaining the method, which is pretty simple to do, whatever arises in meditation is simply what arises. Let it be there. And it's best to avoid using meditation to figure something out.
Mm-hmm.
That's why the instruction is when whatever comes up, and I'm going to talk a little bit more about that in today's Dhamma talk, whatever comes up is simply what's come up. Be mindful of it. You know, I have a feeling, I have it might be a resentment, it might be a fear, it might be something that's exciting that might be coming up in the future. I'm getting a new car tomorrow, whatever, and I'm not. But whatever comes up, come back to the sensation of breathing. And you're training yourself in a very direct way to not have a reactive mind, to simply be present. And I'll talk a little bit more about that again in today's Dhamma talk. So, like I said to Dan, start with short periods of meditation, 2 or 3 or 4 minutes. But consistently, and if you can do that twice a day and be part of our Sangha, pretty soon you'll have the benefits that we all talk about here. So, I'm so glad you're here.
Thank you.
Okay. Jen, welcome.
Thanks.
Thank you for bringing
your
mom.
Yeah. It's nice to be here. So this is my second time through this course, and it's definitely, if I'm totally honest, you know, there was a little bit of ego being like, probably not going to really learn that much more, whatever. But it's been really, you know, that thought or construct, you know, kind of just staying with it anyway is, I'm glad that I've done that, because just simply coming back to the beginning is, so helpful. I mean, all the time, and you can just fall right off the path so easily in an instant, and just get right back on. You know,
okay.
Just in another instant. Just okay. I'm just gonna breathe through my nose and focus on my breath, and you know, watch the thoughts go by and just notice them. And I don't need to do anything about them, and I don't need to defend myself. I don't need to prove a point, or, you know, I just have to allow myself to have these thoughts and allow the people around me to have their thoughts. And so coming back to the, you know, the first teaching has been really, really good, especially now during the holidays when it's very busy. And, you know, no matter how much I am diligent about practicing and doing all the things in my life that I think I should be doing to keep a peaceful mind, just the nature of this time of year creates racing thoughts. It creates, you know, attachments to the events of, you know, Christmas Day, or, you know, I'm getting married 5 days after Christmas, you know, so there's a whole bunch of that to be looking forward to. And, you know, I have to make sure I'm going to be in a good place then so that I can be happy. And, you know, all of that racing stuff that goes on, it was just really nice to be reminded of the fact that actually none of that is what's happening right now. And right now I just need to breathe and move through this day. So thank you for teaching.
Yeah, you're welcome. And thank you. Thank you for saying that. Jen is getting married next Friday to an incredible guy. And she's honored me with performing the ceremony.
Of course.
So,
I'm
so looking forward to it. Oh, I'm glad you're here.
Have you ever done that before, John?
Yep. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. It's a lot of fun. It really is.
Hmm.
Yeah, it is. For everybody. Diane, good to see you this morning. How are you?
Well, thank you. Thank you. Thank you again for continuing to do this.
Like I said last, what else would I do?
Well, we're really lucky, I think, to have you here in Frenchtown. Just picking up a little bit on what everybody said, in my job, it's become a very obvious and important and paramount thing for me to practice loving kindness toward myself first, and that has been a whole mind-shaking kind of thing, because I was raised that you put other people first and you take care of other people first and, you know, put yourself last kind of thing. And to practice love and kindness. And I've gone through the thing about the positive image and, you know, have a positive attitude kind of thing too. But sometimes and I feel like I'm just boiling down to, okay, let's just accept that this is the way it is. Like, this week, several times I had to just leave a situation in order to take care of myself.
Good for you.
And be loving and kind toward myself. And the emotions of this time of year, not even to mention the cold, the stress of cold and trying to stay warm and everything.
Mm-hmm.
As has been mentioned, I just had to keep coming back to my breath that this is now. This is what's happening. And besides all that, a lot of stuff has been coming up in meditation that it's just like, I want to say, oh, just give it a rest, ego. You know, I just want to be done with that. But I think what I say to myself kind of is, well, you started this when you're really old. If you'd started it younger, you know, you might not have so much stuff to go through and stuff like that. But it's the thing is, though, that it's just being with it, as you say, is that's where this is not for the faint of heart. I think that it takes courage to not abandon myself, to not do, purposely change my thinking or direction or something, but to just stay with the feeling and let it be, or the thought or the experience or whatever it is that comes up, the anger, whatever. And that's, what is that, taming a wild elephant? It's like riding a frisky horse on a fall day kind of thing. You just rein it in and rein it in and rein it in and just be there. That's not easy. And this is kind of where Anthony's come talking about a little bit. It takes that love and kindness, that self, it's not, this is the wrong Buddha word, but it's self-appreciation. It's just, I care enough about being that I am willing to just be with this. When I wasn't willing to be with myself, whatever happened. And that's a kind of, not love word, but love, that I've never really known before with myself, to care enough to be there. It's like, you know, it almost feels like I'm mothering an infant, you know, a helpless child, and giving the love that, you know, maybe I did or didn't receive or something like that. It's just caring that much for myself. And then what is so fantastic is when I see someone else going through the same, you know, through a struggle, it's like, okay, I understand. And there isn't the judgment or the condemnation or the even the repellingness.
Avoiding.
Of it. I'm just able to be there, which is helpful in my job. But then that's again where, I mean, this, it's a wishy-washy, and not wishy-washy.
It's impermanent.
The mindfulness comes in where I have to realize that I cannot have so much empathy for another that I lose the respect and dignity of being.
Wow.
And that's not, all of that is not, you know, it's a practice, and that's where, you know, and I'm finding out sometimes too in this, too, practicing twice a day, I have been really rigid with myself, saying, you know, you do 20 minutes in the morning, so you have to do 20 minutes in the evening. And I'm saying, you know, just go into the cushion in the evening for, even if 5 minutes is better than not doing it at all. And I'm being gentle with myself about that second practice, because, and you know, sometimes I can do 20 minutes, but you know, just going at it, I mean, even if I stop where I am for a minute and pay attention to that, you know, give it my mindfulness, I'm better off.
Thank you. You said a lot, and I'm glad you did. We get to develop real patience with other people once we start understanding the nature of our own contributions to stress and unhappiness. Because we understand it in ourselves, we can understand that when other people start displaying less than ideal behavior or actions, we don't have to judge them harshly because we've stopped judging ourselves harshly. That's, again, it's a key to the Dhamma. Treat yourself with great gentleness and great kindness. I know you've heard me say it's a practice of ease and joy, but it isn't for the faint of heart. You know, and that, again, it points back to that gentleness, and it points back to the necessity of the Eightfold Path as a framework, because it's too easy to get distracted by the difficulties that arise within Dhamma practice. And if we didn't have that framework, we wouldn't be able to see what's happening. Our natural tendency, our conditioned response, is when something is difficult or seemingly painful, we need to avoid it, get away from it, including what comes up in meditation practice. But if we remember, we'll talk about it a little bit, for a foundation of mindfulness, meditation is primarily for deepening concentration. So no matter what comes up, if we come back to the sensation of breathing, we're interrupting that own contribution to ongoing stress. You know, and it works beautifully. Thank you for everything you said, Diane. Lisa, good to see you this morning. How are you? How's your study going?
My nose is stuck. Meditation is kind of haphazard, but I am managing to do something every day.
Good for you.
I'm hoping to work towards, you know, something organized. But I may not be doing meditation that is, you know, exactly what I write about in the book and what you're talking about, because I do other forms of it. And when I but my body knows, I've been meditating, you know, for a few years here and there, you know, nothing super organized, but my body knows when I lay down or sit or whatever and I start breathing in, breathing out, it's like my body knows.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, we're meditating now.
Yep.
What kind of meditation it is, I don't really know. I have to, it seems like right now when I meditate, you're talking about the breath, but I have to say, I say to myself silently, breathe in, breathe out. And I don't know whether that's like what I should be doing. And so that takes care of the chatter and the voices and like the zillions of things going, you know, running in the background.
Yeah.
If I say to myself, breathe in, breathe out. And, but then there's also the problem of like the mind's eye. So I sometimes visualize a yellow rose. So I don't visualize like 10,000 other things because that's distracting. So, you know, I try to do that. It's not, you know, as far as when I do, it's not all that organized. And I don't know what to say because, like, everybody said really interesting, emotional, and all kinds of things here. And then that kind of fills up my head. And then I don't know what to think, you know, about anything. And we're, you know, we listened to the first two, what are they are? The what?
The recordings.
Yeah, the recordings. I read the chapters, you know, and I can't seem to remember one thing from 1 minute to the next. I'm trying to remember one thing, and, you know, I'm trying to remember, you know, because it's new terminology.
Yep.
And things like that, but. I personally definitely have anger management problems, and so, you know, meditation, I know that it's going to be really good for me, because I keep coming, I'm coming back.
Yeah.
I don't know, you know, I'm not sure why, because I can't, I feel dumb, because I can't remember anything, but I'm going to do it anyway, no matter how I feel about it.
Yeah. Good for you. Yeah, when I first came across the just the terminology of the Eightfold Path, it probably took me a couple of years to really integrate it. For that length of time, if somebody asked me what are they, I probably couldn't have told you, because it's unfamiliar. It does take us a while to integrate it, but every time we go through this, I mean, I have students online too that will say the same thing. They're going through the course a second time. And they get so much more out of it because they've developed a reference point for how to understand it. So don't be too concerned that you can't remember all the phrases or anything. It's through the practice. When the students would ask the Buddha this, and he would use this word, ehipasikam, which means come and see for yourself. You really have to experience it. We first engage in anything as human beings intellectually. That's how we are, you know, that's part of our senses. But then we start integrating it. And as you describe, it's taking time. Almost every student I've ever had says the same thing. The practice takes a while to build. I don't know how many. I have very few people that meditated 20 minutes a day, twice a day, right off the bat, and were able to do that. Most people can, but you're.
It's called practice.
Yeah, it's called practice, and you're doing the most important thing, which is to be part of a sangha. You know?
Well, so, I have to understand. It's okay not to know, not to understand. Yep.
Mm-hmm. Yep. It is.
It's a process. And what we're talking about is that what we're reading about what you start out with, but then it says, well, later on in 7, 8, or 9, then we'll do that and you'll understand it. So it's kind of like the whole thing is, it's not linear. It's circular.
It's not.
Yeah.
No.
You can't even do what you're doing until you get to later on, but you don't do that till later on, so how do you know what you're doing?
Yeah,
we're going around in circles and... But that's okay. I'm going to make one Christmas reference. Our favorite movie of all time is A Christmas Carol with Alistair Sims. There's been a lot of versions.
Yep.
And there's one part where Wink finally, you know, wakes up and he's dancing and he says, I don't know anything. And he's like dancing on one foot and dancing on that. We haven't seen it this year, so, you know, we have to see it again. but he is so delighted not to know anything.
Right. He's dancing because he realized he's let go of all those views that kept him miserable all those years. Yeah, that's why he's so happy, and that's what we're doing here too. So that's a great analogy. Thank you for bringing it up. I'm gonna look forward to it. I haven't watched it in years, but I still remember it. So, and it is, it's that's why it takes the Eightfold Path. Remember, the Buddha didn't just say meditate, and that was going to be it, because he realized we needed something to recognize and abandon our conditioned thinking, and meditation is just one factor of it. And if you remember that meditation is to deepen concentration, then it makes sense. We need a well-concentrated mind to hold in mind the other factors of the Eightfold Path, and that's how the Dhamma develops. But very quickly, and you reference the later chapters in the book help make sense out of what you've already studied. And it took me a little while to figure out exactly the sequencing in there so that that would happen. But again, it's you need to read, you need to develop the entire practice, but it doesn't take all that much time, you know, and it starts falling into place pretty quickly once you develop that. I'm glad you're here today. Jay, good to see you. How are you? How's your practice going?
The mechanics of the practice seem to be getting better on some days, and some days I'm kind of spinning my wheels a little bit. The cat has realized that when he sees me get the cushions out, it's a good time to come over and ask for a scratch under the chin or whatever, rub up against my knee, and that puts me off. And the phone rings or whatever. But when I do manage to do the mechanics, you know, go to the breathing and stop thinking about playing whack-a-mole with all the thoughts, you know. It's been better, and I've been a little more calm, a little less anxious. I've had some things going on. I have two daughters, which is enough to make me nuts in one way anyway. And, you know, issues with both good, bad, and whatever. I started a few weeks ago volunteering at an old age home, and that has been challenging to get in the right frame of mind. What I'm doing is visiting people who don't get visitors, really. And so I'm trying to be genuine with them and not get freaked out the day before myself, you know, like, what the heck am I going to, how am I going to communicate with these folks? Or some of them are, you know, in really bad shape. But, you know, much as listening to everybody here, you see people walking around in the street or whatever, you say, oh, boy, they got their act together. You know, that everyone looks like they have everything all straightened out. And here you can see that everyone has the same issues, you know. And it's the same with going to that old age home. You see the reality. Somehow it makes you feel better to know that, you know, other people have issues or things going on. I don't have much else to say. I have, less things, because we don't celebrate Christmas, so we don't have all that weight of, you know, expectations and obligations, you know. All we got to do is, you know, light some candles, fry up some potato pancakes, and we're good. You know, so.
Sounds like a plan.
We have less of that kind of baggage. And I just muddle on through, you know, trying to keep up with the meditation. But I don't have to know why it works, but it seems like it is working.
Yeah, that's all you need to know. So, when the Buddha described dukkha, he described it this way. Birth is dukkha, or birth is painful. Sickness is painful. Aging is painful. Death is painful. Not getting what is wanted is painful. Getting what is not wanted is painful. And then he said, in short, the five clinging aggregates are dukkha. Five clinging aggregates are basically self-referential views. So he's describing just every human life. And it's the reaction that life should be different than it is that causes, that is our contribution to our stress. And what you're doing, volunteering for the elderly, is a remarkable expression of that understanding. But years ago, I read a biography of Mother Teresa. I've mentioned this here before. And it was remarkable. One thing, I still remember one thing that I learned that really shocked me then. And it's such an important understanding. My understanding of Mother Teresa was that she was someone who tirelessly, 24/7, was working with the worst of the worst in Calcutta. And what I found out was that her and her nuns spent 6 hours every day in prayer and meditation in preparation for being able to do that.
Wow.
And we're doing the same. Yeah. That helped put the importance of developing myself through meditation in perspective. It's necessary. And also, if you remember, the Buddha's set out on understanding out of an incredible level of compassion. He wanted to understand the nature of human suffering and was there a way to bring it to cessation. But he didn't teach anything until he understood the process. In other words, he didn't reach out to help people until he was well prepared himself. And that's not to say we shouldn't reach out a hand until we're awakened, but to recognize, and Diane talked about it too, we need to take care of ourselves first. It sounds almost counterintuitive or selfish, but until we really understand the nature of human life, how can we be of true service to others? How can we remain present with other people? And things change. When we stop reacting and taking things personally, we're able to stay in an adversarial situation without becoming adversarial ourselves. So, thank you for saying that, Jay. Debbie, good to see you. How are you this morning?
Good to see you and everyone, John. To do this on Christmas Eve, it's very unique for me.
Yeah.
So Christmas is a huge thing in my family on the West Coast and my family here and my family and friends. So I've been very busy.
Yeah.
And, when I was putting up the tree the other night, at one point I was like, I went to this place that, oh, I'm kind of tired putting up a tree and taking down the tree and all this stuff and blah, blah, blah. Though there's part of me that gets joy out of that, especially that my daughter's coming and that she'll get joy out of that, you know. So, but then I just stopped. And I really, that tree is a big symbol for me this year because it was, kind of putting this practice into place, It's like, and the key word for me all this season has been acceptance. You just accept the present moment and you're in it and you're doing it when you're baking cookies or when you're wrapping gifts or buying gifts, to really just be in it with the non-resistance and the acceptance just allows for joy, actually. So the mindfulness has been really helpful for me, I think, bringing me back. And also I've had to deal with, I had somebody rear-end me, and then last night my spouse hit a deer, and her brand new car was very messed up, and it's like the everyday stuff is still there, even though we're in this season of a lot,
Yeah.
And I work, of course, for clients, it's a hard season too. So, so it's just helpful, this acceptance. I've always said in my practice, I've always felt that acceptance was a key word to healing.
Yeah.
And now I have it in a new kind of context, I guess. It's a new layer of understanding for me. So I was thinking about what Anthony was saying, and I was thinking, being a therapist and you're doing cognitive therapy at the time and you're doing the positive thinking, it's like, but I was thinking about how the non-resistance, the acceptance to the present moment allows that surrender and allows so much positivity to come out of that there it is, there's the, just being in the moment is, so positive.
Yeah.
And, it gets rid of all the thinking that's creating the suffering, so.
A lot of pressure.
Yeah.
There's big signs that say joy everywhere.
Yeah.
I'm not feeling that joy. What's wrong with me?
Yeah. Yep, that's right. I should, especially this time of year, I should be happy and joyful all the time.
But the thing is, the more we accept that, we don't feel that and just go into, okay, right now I feel overwhelmed.
Yeah.
Breathe into the overwhelm. Some peace comes out.
Yeah.
So there's the joy for me.
Yep.
Peace. Yes. So it's not working all the time, but it's definitely different in helping, and I haven't been great about the studying. You know, I really felt bad about, I mean, I really felt like I missed something last week because I didn't catch up. I didn't do my homework. I didn't read. You know, I just haven't had time, and I'm just trying to accept that, too. That's good. Okay. You know, I'm just doing what I can do. I've done my practice every day, and that's important. Probably, you know, to me, it's that's something. And just accepting that I haven't kept up is just part of the acceptance, you know.
It is. Mm-hmm. Thank you for saying that, too.
Insurance and all that. That's what I got to do, so I got to do it.
Yep. Thank you, Debbie. Yeah, you got to do it. But we can't beat ourselves up if we happen to fall short one day or miss a session or whatever, or just react. It's just the way it is. The difference that we learn, like getting back to this, the positive theme, the Buddha described an awakened human being, the condition of their mind as calm, a mind of resting in equanimity, meaning no matter what occurs, we maintain this peaceful quality of mind. And that comes from understanding the difference between acceptance and approval. We have it wired to ourselves. I mean, it's part of the Western mindset, but it's also more or less global today, that in order for me to accept something, I first have to approve of it. And there's that self-referential view. But when we develop the understanding that dukkha occurs in life, then we can accept a situation that previously to that we wouldn't approve of. I don't want any part of this. And that's what creates the real stress and tension in our lives.
Yeah.
Dukkha occurs. I accept it. And also the understanding of impermanence helps a great deal with that, because then we can understand whatever I'm feeling or experiencing right now, if I take a breath or two or three or ten, it's going to change. And there's nothing I have to do about it. I can trust in impermanence. And I can trust in the ability, in the Vitakkasanthana Sutta, the Buddha says you'll gain the ability to think what you want to think when you want to think it. Isn't that incredible? No matter what's occurring, I can have an adversarial lawyer screaming at me, but I can control my thinking and remain at peace, no matter what occurs.
You know, John, when I knew my father was going to die, I, being the oldest brother, I called the other two brothers, and one came in right away to see him, and the other one didn't want to come in. Mm-hmm. And he was saying, well, I can't let this get to me, and I can't get stressed. And then originally, I was angry about it, and then I realized everybody responds to death differently.
Yep.
And some people go under a hole, they go under a rock, and some people want to be at the bedside holding the person's hand. And it's just, when I learned to accept that, even though I didn't approve of it, I felt a lot better.
Yeah.
So that's, I understand what you're saying.
Yeah, you accept what occurs. Years ago, my father turned 80 around that time. Every time I'd go see him, I'd walk out of the house thinking this is the last time I'm ever going to see him again. You know, and it was tough to deal with. I mean, that was kind of a realistic thought, I guess. But you got me thinking, Diane, when you said you were old, you're not old. I saw my dad the other day. He's 98 years old now.
Wow.
He's old.
Wow. Wow.
But he doesn't think it. I said, how you doing, Dad? He said, trying to make it to 100. he's enjoying that process. He's accepted, and he's not a Buddhist, he thinks what I do is crazy. But he's accepted that this is what's occurring. I'm 98, you know, he can't walk too good, he still thinks pretty good, he eats great, he doesn't see good, you know. But this is what it is, he's enjoying his life, so good for him. Lorna, good to see you this morning.
Thank you. Thinking the other day that probably we can all think back on Christmas Eve, Christmas Day, way back into our childhood and remember this day, and talk about referential views. I mean, we can go back in, you know, to our children and think about, oh, what Christmas should be, it shouldn't be, it should be this way, it should be that way. And so I was just thinking that, you know, it comes with a lot of referential views.
Yeah.
And knowing what we've learned about referential views, you know, we have to let those go and be more pleasant and things like that. So this time of the year it is sort of like a revolving door, really. And then there was one sentence. Can I just bring one sentence up in your passage?
Sure.
Mind in a distracted state is focused outside the physical body. You have to. I feel like I disagree with that, so you'll have to explain it to me. But for instance, if you're in pain, I mean really bad pain, you're distracted, but it's not outside your body. So I just, when I read that, it didn't line up with my thinking. And then if you can answer that, and then there's just one other thing. Just thinking about Christmas and often the indulgences that go along with Christmas, and we overeat, we overdrink, we overdo everything. It's Christmas, so we do it. And I think the work that I've done with Matt this year, and the Qigong, and appreciating my body, whereas previous Christmases I thought it was Christmas, therefore really my body just has to go along with it. The indulgences that I put my body through, my body just has to go along with it. I've never messed with it. But this year I think I'm more aware of my oneness, that I can't indulge my body, stress my body, without stressing me.
Yeah.
And that oneness of that I'm one person, and just that thought that, you know, you can't be one without the other, and if you're going to be kind to yourself, you've got to be kind to your body, and just the oneness of thought that brings, I think, has come to me this year, this Christmas, where I've never thought that previously. You know, it's like you drink too much, you eat too much, you know, it's Christmas. And I've thought that way, but as I say, I'm thinking differently now. But anyway, if you could explain how, you know, your thoughts are outside the physical body when they're distracted.
I can't explain. I don't know what that means.
You wrote
that. So the pain is in your body, but you're... And remembering the context, this is in the chapter on the four foundations of mindfulness. So the pain is obviously in your body, or it feels like it's in your body. But the self-referential thought is, I don't want this pain. And that creates a separation from the reality that you have the pain. It's here. So if you're saying yourself, I don't accept the pain, you're treating the pain as if it's something separate from yourself. So it in that way, it's an external view. We'll get right into the talk on the four foundations of mindfulness. The four foundations of mindfulness, the first foundation is to be mindful of the breath and the body. And if you recognize, this is what we do in meditation. The second foundation of mindfulness is to be mindful that feelings are arising. But what the Buddha's teaching to be mindful of, or the mindfulness in that application, is to do it in a non-self-referential or not taking it personal. So feelings arise, it's not my pain. It's simply something that's arising. The third foundation of mindfulness is thoughts arising. And usually our thoughts are driven by our feelings. And if we allow that process to continue, then it becomes a distraction. And it impacts the fourth foundation of mindfulness, which is the present quality of our mind. In other words, if we are in meditation, we first become mindful of the sensation of breathing in our bodies. And that begins to quiet our minds. And we're able then to recognize that a feeling arises, and it might be a pain in my body. And if the thought that is driven from that feeling is, I don't want this pain, or I shouldn't have this pain, or where did this pain come from, or why did that person step on my foot yesterday and cause the pain, your mind is lost. You've developed an aspect of mindlessness. Rather than simply recognizing the process... And let me go back just a little bit. And that process, that reactive process, results in a distracted and disturbed quality of mind. But if we can remain mindful of simply this process occurring, the quality of our mind isn't impacted, and we're able to have a peaceful mind despite a pain in our body. And you described that pretty beautifully when you said, I'm developing the oneness of who I am, because you're not using self-referential views anymore to describe yourself. You're simply staying present with what has occurred. So does that help answer your question?
Yes, it does, but I think it's a stretch. You know, if you've got pain in your body, you've got pain in your, you know, coming back.
Oh, believe me, I know. I deal with that all the time. But it's no longer a distraction. I'm not treating the pain in my body as a separate object. There's not a subject-object relationship anymore. It's simply what's occurring. And again, the usefulness of that isn't whether my view of the pain in my knee is external or internal. The usefulness of that is in the broader framework of developing a dispassionate response to what's occurring in life. So getting back to the talk, the four foundations of mindfulness, the Buddha taught mindfulness in two very specific applications. One is the four foundations of mindfulness. The other is to be mindful of each factor of the Eightfold Path. So the four foundations of mindfulness is primarily what we do in meditation, and it's taught that way so that we can develop that non-reactive mind in meditation. Simply observing this process occurring and not reacting to it and maintaining a present quality of a calm and peaceful mind. Now, our meditation practice then is preparing us for life off our cushion when things occur in life. We get a lawyer screaming at us in court, but we've developed that well-concentrated, dispassionate way of dealing with feelings and thoughts, and we're able to maintain a calm and peaceful mind. That's the importance of the four foundations of mindfulness. Again, it's not, and the reason why I say that is some of the later developed schools treat mindfulness, the four foundations of mindfulness, in this very long and intricate way, and be mindful of this and be mindful of that. And I won't get into the whole explanation in the Satipatthana Sutta. But the Buddha taught those more elaborate aspects of mindfulness, simply describing what we should be mindful of in a dispassionate way, but not to use that in our meditation. In meditation, the four foundations of mindfulness are applied to simply recognize that process. Be mindful of the breath in the body. Whatever occurs, to recognize that it's occurred. In other words, it's created a distraction in your mind. Come back to the sensation of breathing. Now, it's not always feelings driving thoughts. Sometimes it's a thought that arises. I remember that argument I had with that lawyer yesterday, and that remembrance drives a feeling, and we get angry over it. When that occurs, you simply acknowledge it in your meditation, and come back to the sensation of breathing. Do you see the words foundation? So the foundation is your breath. And by remaining mindful of the breath in the body, no matter what's occurring, then we are able to maintain a mind of peace and calm. So when a pain occurs, and we start that subject-object relationship with pain and realize that, no, I'm reacting to the pain now. I want it to be different, or I want to figure it out, or whatever we might do with it, simply come back to the sensation of breathing. And we're interrupting the externally objectified view of the pain. And we're simply staying with what's occurring.
John, in that sense, is it like, Eckhart Tolle, when he talks about like the pain body and being in the ego, you're sort of staying in that body of pain. The pain can be physical or mental.
Yep.
Really, because you can go deeper than that level of pain. I mean, sort of like childbirth is, like, I watched my wife, we had three water births with our children, two of which were in my living room. There's nothing more, you know, extreme of that pain.
Yeah.
If you can't be in that pain and manage it and, you know, find a calm place, I think that's sort of the epiphany of it in that sense.
Yeah. And, again, all of that describes even the process of giving birth is described as in the First Noble Truth. Dukkha occurs. The reason why, at first, that sounds like, well, you know, why is that so important? But that's the essence of everything. Because most of us are trained to spend our lives chasing after what gives us pleasure and avoiding anything that might bring us pain. When the fact of the matter is, they're both aspects, and you could say extreme aspects, of simple human life. They're going to occur. You know? Diane, you had your hand up?
Just going to say that for me, I'm finding that I kind of am in a state of meditation all day, because when dukkha occurs, you know, off the cushion, I take a breath.
Yeah.
And it helps. So, I mean, what you're saying, when I'm applying it, when to have the mindfulness that when, you know, someone is in your face, to take a breath and not respond is a benefit of the practice. For sure.
Oh, it's remarkable. I mean, I was born arguing, and I developed a real craving for argument. I love to argue with people, and even if my understanding was completely different, I would take an opposite view just to have an argument. And it was really ridiculous. But I spent my whole life with this agitated mind, almost looking for argument. But when I developed the Dhamma just a little bit and was able to let that go, how freeing is it to be in a situation that normally would create an incredible amount of stress, self-induced stress, and now I can just be peaceful and calm. I don't have to be right. Notice that the I in there. I don't have to be right. What that gives me is the ability to just be. You don't have to be anything different. There's nothing personal in it. The four foundations of mindfulness teach us how to develop a life that is impersonal. I don't have to continually establish myself in everything that occurs. I don't have to take the pain in my leg personally or in my mind. I can be at peace with a less than peaceful mind state, with the understanding that the quality of my mind is always changing. But if it's attached to external views, then I'm in trouble. Then I'm always subject to stress, aren't I? The four foundations of mindfulness. So this week's homework is to study or read the chapter on the four foundations of mindfulness, and we'll discuss it next Saturday's class. So, excuse me, any other questions or comments on that? Yes, Lisa.
A mindfulness meditation teacher, it's probably a quote she said, but, you know, when I first heard it, she said, we're human beings, not human doings. Hmm.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. And the mindfulness that the Buddha teaches is a very specific type of mindfulness. It's to hold in mind the four foundations of mindfulness during meditation. And we'll talk more about this as the course progresses too. And to hold in mind each factor of the Eightfold Path as the framework for developing true understanding. So that's the important thing. So, great class. Let's finish with the Buddha's words on metta. So find your relaxed meditative posture. Gently close your eyes and gently close your mouth. And again, take a moment to become aware of the sensation of breathing in your body. And let that mindfulness of your breath cease any distracting thoughts to the past or to the future or that may have arisen from our talk today. And metta is both an aspiration for those of us developing the Eightfold Path and as an ongoing expression of a fully awakened, fully mature human being. And these are the Buddha's words on metta. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied. Unburdened with duties and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud or demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. Wishing in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings. Radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will. Whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Thank you all for a wonderful class. Merry Christmas. Peace.